Thank you, Andrea, for the kind introduction, and thank to Dave and his staff for making this this event possible. I'd say I bring you greetings from Prince Edward Island, except that I noticed that an MP from Prince Edward Island, Sean Murphy, has just entered the room, so I'm sure he will join me in this welcome from PEI. I think what I'd like to do to begin is talk autobiographically, just for a moment. Andrea mentioned that I have a book coming out in the spring with Oxford University Press, which is entitled Where Have All the Babies Gone? The subtitle at the moment isn't settled, so our working subtitle for this morning is The Birth Dearth and What to Do About It. I started writing or researching this book a number of years ago, actually, interested in the history of the family planning movement and its work in the developed world and in the developing world. And like most academics, I started with the idea of writing a book for other academics. And these tend to be books that don't particularly excite me, but I thought, well, this is a book I was under contract to write, so I'm going to get on and write it. And then I sort of experienced a kind of epiphany at a certain point in my research, because I realized that, or I noted, that here were people with the family planning movement, and they were taking credit at the end of the 20th century for the stunning drop in fertility right across the globe, beginning with the 1960s and right up to the present day. And I said, well, they're taking credit for it. Let's see if it's true. And in fact, the book is mainly about, although it will talk about some of the things I'll be discussing this morning, the book is mainly about how the family planning movement, with an emphasis on those who promoted tubal ligation and vasectomy as forms of birth control, how they actually succeeded in this endeavor, which has, as we all know, done nothing less than change the course of human history. It's a remarkable, remarkable event. So once I had this epiphany, this illumination, I found that writing and finishing the book was a lot easier. So this is what I'm going to be talking about this morning. I'm talking about it, as Andrew mentioned, from the perspective of an historian who, when he ventures into fields such as public policy, feels a little less sure. So as long as you bear with me, especially when I get to the section on public policy, as long as you bear with me, I think that I may have some interesting stuff to tell you. And also, just serendipitously, with regard to the Russian story, I'm teaching a course on Russian history at UPI right at this moment, and I mentioned this anecdote the other day in my class, and the students who know some Russian history got special thrill out of it and saw the humor, because it's very typical of what happens in Russia, at least in the sense of top-down reform always coming from the top, from the government, and being imposed from the top down. Okay, where have all the babies gone? The birth dearth and what to do about it. This is also the second time, only the second time I've done PowerPoint. So again, please bear with me on this. Now, I use the term the birth dearth. Others call it the empty cradle or the coming demographic winter. But they all basically refer to the same thing, and that is the dramatic drop in global birth rates over the last 50 years. And I think this was expressed rather well by Ben Wattenberg, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. And he writes, never have birth and fertility rates fallen so far, so fast, so long, and in so many places, so surprisingly. This is the magnitude of the series of events I'm talking about this morning. So, this is the problem. This is the issue. And what I'm going to be doing in the next couple of minutes, I'm just going to briefly summarize the main points I want to get across in the talk, and then we'll talk in a little more detail about the basic issues and so on. But who has noticed this tremendously important phenomenon. Andrea mentioned the article in the Hill Times, which just came to my attention just the other day. So, and the title in the Hill Times article refers to the stunning silence that exists in Ottawa surrounding this issue. So, who's noticed? Well, it turns out that over the last few years, articles have appeared on this topic of the birth dearth in prestigious journals like Foreign Affairs, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Germany's Der Spiegel, and also books have been coming out in the last few years. See, I'm not the only one. I'm not claiming any originality in detecting this trend. There's social scientists who have researched this, have written about it, as we speak, more stuff is coming out. One of the books is Wattenberg's Fewer, How the New Demography Will Shape Our Future. There's another one, Bare Branches, the Security Implications of Age's Surplus Male Population, which I'll talk about in a minute. Philip Longman's The Empty Cradle, How Falling Birth Rates Threaten World Prosperity. And I'll talk a little bit about Philip Longman in a second. Governments around the world, from France to Russia, as we've seen, to South Korea, they're taking action to address the birth dearth. The government of South Korea has just pledged, I think it is $20 billion U.S. to boost birth rates. So governments are paying attention. So prime ministers, presidents, and even, of course, the Pope has been talking about this basic issue. So why should we be concerned about the birth dearth? Well, we should be concerned about it because it's steadily creating an imbalance between young and old that could cripple future generations. It's producing the steady aging of societies, due, of course, to the fact that people are enjoying longer life expectancy, longer than ever before. Modern medicine is helping this, of course, but also because family size is getting smaller, and what you're getting is, of course, more and more senior citizens in ratio, in proportion to younger workers in the economy. And this is going to lead to problems I'm going to be talking about in a minute. So the other point I'd like to make is its impact on virtually every facet of life is bound to increase in time. If you think about the birth dearth and you think about its many dimensions, there is almost no area of human endeavor, no policy field that is immune to the influence, will be immune ultimately to the influence of the birth dearth. If something isn't done now to reverse this trend, the birth dearth is likely to become the most pressing policy issue facing politicians, social scientists, opinion makers, and ordinary citizens. And I also want to add that this is an issue whose magnitude and seriousness transcend partisan politics and ultimately will unite people from every location on the political spectrum. We've seen a sign of this in the fact that Philip Longman, who wrote The Empty Cradle, is the senior research fellow at the liberal new, and that's small L liberal, the liberal New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. And he agrees essentially with Ben Wattenberg, who is a fairly well-known conservative pundit in the United States. So, again, you get representatives from very different parts of the political spectrum agreeing on the gravity of this particular problem. Now, another point I'm going to make this morning is the birth dearth did not happen because people wanted it. You've probably heard, and you'll undoubtedly hear in future, that we have falling birth rates because of popular demand, of personal preference. Well, the polls, as we're going to see, say otherwise. And the ideal family size for Canadians is actually larger than the current national birth rate, and it's actually larger than the replacement value, which is 2.1. Another point I want to make is public policy can influence individual behavior, even in an area as private as the issue of reproduction and fertility. Solutions, I think, are straightforward, and involve relatively little government intervention in the private lives of Canadians. Now, we can all think of other solutions which involve proactive government policies which do intervene, involve themselves in the private lives of Canadians, and do cost a lot of money. But what I'm going to be arguing today is that there are some very basic, at least first steps we can take from a policy direction that can help to solve the question. And the time to tackle the problem is now. If everybody else around the globe is mobilizing to tackle this problem, surely the time has come for Ottawa to pay attention, because our birth rate, which we'll see in a minute, it's only 1.5 children per woman of childbearing woman. That is one of the lowest in the world. Luckily, not the lowest, but one of the lowest. Okay, so let's move on to the issue here. For decades, as again, I'm sure you know, the debate over population has been dominated by the view that the world is overpopulated. And we hear this time and again through the media. We hear influential and wealthy individuals such as Ted Turner, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, as well as organizations like the Sierra Club, United Nations Fund for Population Assistance, the group that used to be called Zero Population Growth, which now calls itself the Population Connection. Interesting change of nomenclature. Of course, these groups have repeatedly insisted that the globe, to use Turner's own words, well, here we are, to use Ted Turner's own words, the globe is infested with a plague of people. And this tends to be the, as we say in social science, the hegemonic view. And then we get it from people like Bill McKibben, very well-known environmentalist author of a famous book, The End of Nature. He wrote a book in 1997, essentially celebrating the fact that he had had a vasectomy and he only had one child. And he said, in order to save the planet, this is why he did it, single child families should be the cultural norm. And of course, there's the role of family planning NGOs, or non-governmental organizations, in this process. These groups have voiced viewpoints similar to the viewpoints I've just mentioned. But officially, their main concern has been providing the information and services that enable women and their partners to avoid unwanted pregnancies. However, just studying the history of this movement, it's clear that this emphasis on reproductive choice, notwithstanding, they have also been motivated by the belief that, as one historian has said, the belief that too many babies are being born to the wrong women in the wrong places. So the combined impact of these forces is a cultural climate that discourages people from having children. However, The mounting evidence is that the greater danger facing nations today is actually depopulation, not overpopulation. And if it weren't for people like Philip Longman and Ben Wattenberg writing about this, I think the hegemonic view would continue. Let's take a look at some of the numbers from places like Europe. Birth rates there have dipped well below the replacement value of 2.1 children. Germany, it's 1.4. Italy, Spain, 1.3. Russia loses 750,000 people now per year. Hence the kind of initiative that Andrea was telling us about, shows the desperation. The president of Russia has called Russia's loss of population a national crisis. And a Washington Post columnist, Robert J. Samuelson, fairly well known, he has written for Newsweek, I believe, in the past, wrote a column saying, based on these numbers, are we witnessing the end of Europe? I mean, when you look at the Russian example, you can see that we're talking about, in some cases, the disappearance of entire nations. Well, the argument goes, it's true, industrialized societies like Europe, like North America, the birth rates are very low. But of course, in the developing world, fertility rates are very high, and we have to pursue population control in these areas. Well, actually, in Asia, in a lot of countries in Asia, what we see is the birth dearth is afflicting them as well. Japan, 1.3. Average age in Japan is 43 years old. Japan's Minister of Gender and Equality and Social Affairs in 2005 said there was a sense of crisis surrounding Japan's future. China, 1.7. Of course, this is thanks to its notorious one-child policy, which has been in effect since the late 1970s. And this is involved, this is a very controversial policy, of course, most of you know about it, limiting most couples to a single child. Punishments for violating this one-child law have included the forfeiture of jobs and housing, severe penalties in a country whose government controls these sectors of society. Women who have been convicted of breaking this law have been forced to undergo tubal sterilizations or abortions. And the policy that worked, the policy has worked in that it's lowered China's birth rate from about 6 children per woman to 1.7, but of course it's exacted a tremendous toll on the human rights of countless individual Chinese citizens, and it's cast, as we're going to see, a dark shadow over the nation's future. Well, what about Canada? Of course, we're mainly interested in Canada. Our birth rate has dropped from 4 in 1950 to 2.34 in 1970. To 1.51 in 2002. Here's some more statistics for you. Fertility rate for women aged 25 to 29. 1994 to 2003, annual number of births fell by 14%. If current trends continue, by 2017, Canada's 150th anniversary, there will be more Canadians over 65 than under 15. And Statistics Canada in its prosaic prose, says this would be an unprecedented situation in Canadian history. So, what are the consequences of the birth dearth? Let's take a look at three that I think are particularly important. Who will pay the bills? Aging societies call into question government's ability to pay for social programs, including Social Security and Medicare. In China, for example, this is a real problem that's facing policymakers. And I remind you, China is where roughly 1 out of every 5 of the world's people reside. And Chinese lawmakers are just beginning to grapple with these kinds of challenges. Duty to die. Well, of course, in aging societies, this fosters support for the rationing of health care and right to die legislation, and it's because the elderly are increasingly viewed, perceived to be a burden on a financially strapped medical system. And so what we see is the birth dearth is affecting policy reform in this particular area. It's driving, in some cases, some of the campaigning for right to die legislation. In fact, Derek Humphrey, who founded the Hemlock Society back in 1980, co-founded it actually, he has written as recently as the year 2000 that economics are going to eventually culminate in the legalization of either physician-assisted suicide or voluntary lethal injection. And he says it's just going to be driven by economics. Where the girls aren't? Well, propaganda in favor of birth control and the introduction of sophisticated medical technology produces a gender imbalance that's skewed in favor of males. And this is particularly the case in China and in India, where 40% of the population, those two countries, 40% of the population reside in those two countries alone. And what we're seeing is that a lot of people, because of the emphasis on birth control, and because of this sophisticated medical technology which enables you to detect the sex of the fetus, they're aborting young infant girls. And this is producing, a gender imbalance, a ratio, boy-girl ratio, skewed in favor of males. Well, we could say a lot about why that is it's undesirable. But one of the things that China in particular is worried is that they've got now millions of unmarried, underemployed, unhappy, and rootless surplus men, and they're worried that these guys are going to get involved in gang activity. They're already seeing this, and that's, of course, going to threaten law and order. And also, you're going to have millions of young men with nothing to do. Well, you can stick them in the army, and if they're in the army, of course, that creates militarism and so on. So it could actually impact international relations. In any case, in the end analysis, the species has been altered in ways never before seen in history. So it's partly due to new medical technology, but it's also due to, again, the population issues. Okay, what are the causes? First of all, again, to get back to this point that's important, the birth death trend is not driven by popular preference. Polls, including the Gallup poll, which is done in 1997, included 16 countries on four continents, including Canada, shows that the ideal family size is consistently higher than the replacement rate of 2.1. Iceland, Guatemala, and Taiwan average ideal family size was as high as 3. In Canada, France, Mexico, and the United States, it ranged from 2.4 to 2.6. One of the interesting things about this Gallup poll, though, was that 1 in 3 Canadians said the ideal family size was 3 or more children. 1 in 3. So, what is preventing men and women from having bigger families? Why have birth rates been plunging over the last half century? Well, there's the factor, of course, of abortion, which, just get you some numbers here, worldwide, back in the 1990s, there were 46 million abortions, 26 million of which were legal. Abortion totals in the United States have been declining somewhat since the early 1990s, but have increased in Canada over the same time period. They're particularly worried about the factor of abortion in Russia, where combined with alcoholism, rampant alcoholism, Russia, as the experts are saying, is experiencing a population implosion. Rising divorce rates. Well, these reflect uncertainty about the future of marriages, and of course, in turn, they tend to lower fertility. So does the shift from countryside to the cities. In countryside, of course, children are valuable assets. In the cities, they're not so valuable, so that's a factor that's infecting the birth dearth. The rise in literacy and educational opportunities for women is another factor that most social scientists acknowledge. Late marriage, for obvious reasons. Sexually transmitted diseases. I'd like to focus, though, on what I think is the biggest cause, and this is the use and advocacy of contraception. A 1998 RAND study found that 40% of the observed decline in fertility in the developing world from the 1960s to the 1990s was due to the impact of family programs alone. That's separate from other factors such as economic development, the old argument that more economic development leads to greater affluence and greater prosperity and therefore smaller family size. That's a separate factor. Changing status of women, that's a separate factor. This is, again, 40% is due to the impact of family planning programs and the way they both they educate and, of course, provide services and training for birth control enterprises programs around the world. Now, I've highlighted this because I think it's important. Present moment is suited to the reassessment of the ideology of the birth control movement because now we're getting growing awareness of the disadvantages of falling birth rates. Surely the time has come to reconsider whether the nation's best interests are served by this ideology. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Solutions. Okay. And here's where I start to wade into policy issues that I'm not entirely comfortable with as an historian, but I'll do my best. Okay. Obviously, we have to make child rearing more affordable. This has been noted by numerous social scientists as well as media pundits. As columnist Dan Gardner of the Ottawa Citizen wrote recently, it no longer pays to have kids. So And research is showing time and time again that the top reason, or a top reason for putting off having children, are financial challenges. So we have to do that. Baby bonus programs could be one of the policy solutions, I suppose. They've been tried in France, Australia, and of course, Quebec ran its own baby bonus program from 1988 to 97, I believe, and it was terminated in 1997. The minister in charge of the program at that time actually said that the program had been a failure, but a recent study done by the C.D. Howe Institute in 2002 said that, and don't ask me how they get to these numbers because I'm not skilled like Paul and the other folks in this room about doing social science research like this, but he determined that 93,000 extra births were produced because of this baby bonus program, which in Quebec paid as much as $8,000 for a third child. Now, he said his calculations told him that each child cost the provincial government $15,000. So it cost $15,000 for each of those 93,000 children. So the question is it worth it? Is it cost effective? And of course, you can argue both sides. You could say it's expensive for government. There's no denying it. But on the other hand, you're producing 93,000 future tax-paying citizens with luck. And so paying taxes over the course of an entire adult life would make back $15,000 and a lot more, of course. So the school is still out on baby bonus programs, but again, they're being used in parts of the world like France, Australia. Now, another area is to reform tax policy, which penalizes single-income families in which one spouse stays home to raise children. As some of you know, single-income families are taxed higher than double-income families, which are making the same total salary. So that's an area of tax policy that certainly could be addressed and made more family-friendly. Tax credits to parents of children in sports and other activities. I think the Harper government has actually started in this direction, but I got an email from a teacher at my son's school the other day saying, well, this is great, except why stop at sports? Why shouldn't they extend these tax credits to parents who pay for their children's piano and dance lessons? So these kinds of tax credits, again, are the tax assistance reforms are the things that I think we could do. Federal government should draft a national action plan on family policy. This is being done in countries such as Latvia. And I think if nothing else, it would help to educate the Canadian citizenry on this particular issue. And it would foster, stimulate, I think, what would be a very productive debate. Now, there's one other thing I'd like to mention. This gets back to my own research on the history of the family planning movement. And that is that I think we should re-examine Ottawa's and the province's funding of organizations that have been preaching population reduction for years domestically and internationally. And I've got several examples of this. I won't go into a lot of detail. I'm talking about organizations like Planned Parenthood Federation of Canada. The group I've been studying for a number of years used to be called the Association for Voluntary Sterilization. It's now called Engender Health, and it has an annual budget of $40 million. I wasn't terribly surprised, but I was mildly surprised to see that it receives Canadian taxpayers' dollars through CEDA, Canadian International Development Agency. Planned Parenthood received over $2 million in federal government funding in 2002, double what it received in 2001. And in 2002, Ottawa accounted for 64% of Planned Parenthood Federation of Canada's spending. Now, I know what objections will come, will materialize. But let me say, the defunding such groups does not mean turning back the clock on women's reproductive rights, nor does it mean pressuring women to have more babies than they wish to bear. No one is advocating a return to the day when contraception was banned. Defunding simply means creating a level playing field that includes groups with no public funding at all. And I think no matter what one feels on the issue of birth control and on the issue of contraception, one, I think, has to recognize, especially the history of these organizations, that they have preached far more than perhaps, certainly than we would have liked. They preached actual population reduction as much as they preached actual affording women reproductive choice. But even if you think that the birth control movement is only interested in providing choice to its clients, I still think that this reform is a fair one, and it creates a level playing field. It's put, I think, rather well by the University of Maryland economist Julian Simon. He said the issue is whether power and funds of government should be used to support campaigns that have tried historically to make people want fewer children. Why should government be paying for this sort of thing? So, conclusions. Let me go over the main points I've tried to mention, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have them as to particular issues that I've raised. The birther is going to be a key concern for governments around the world as the 21st century unfolds. Could be the next global warming issue, in which a lot of people all of a sudden are talking about almost nothing else and would feel committed to this particular issue, and in which, again, a great deal of unanimity can be established amongst people from different political parties, different parts of the political spectrum. The birther touches virtually all major policy fields. I made this point already, including taxation, immigration, healthcare, education, national security, foreign aid, international relations, and so on. Canada needs a just, fair, and sensible public policy when it comes to the interests of the country and the family. Postponing action on the issue jeopardizes our national future. And the time to act is now. And just to end, hoping this will come up, yes. I don't know if you can read that, but as I was doing research on this presentation last summer, vacationing up in the beautiful Laurentian Mountains, I came across this cartoon in the Gazette. And I think it speaks for itself, but as someone who can now foresee the day when I will be retired, it's a sobering thought that someday I could be selling Big Macs over the counter because of the birther. And so I don't know if you can read that, but I thought that was... That cartoon shows, again, that the issue now is beginning to, I think, percolate into public consciousness, and it's becoming... It's soon going to be a topic that many, many of us will be talking about. Thank you very much.